All right. Good morning, everybody. We are live on Facebook, and this is Divorce Friday and TGIDF. And what is that you mean? You say that is, thank goodness it's Divorce Friday. So before we get into anything, I wanted to just share something with you guys, everybody out there, what I did last night. I actually went to a concert, the first time in over a year and a half or almost 2 years. And I don't know if everyone is familiar with the Shaylin Lu up in Rockport. It's an amazing venue, absolutely gorgeous. We saw the 10,000 Maniacs, and it was the fifth time. They had been canceled or postponed five times. And last night they finally got to appear on stage. So it was great. It was an awesome concert. And I highly recommend people, especially going through a divorce, get out and do something, because I'm in such a good mood today. So on that note, I'm also in a good mood because we have attorney Sandra Lundy here with us today. And Sandy is a family law attorney who's been practicing for 33 years. She is a super lawyer. And I love what she does. She's super smart. Why she probably got the super lawyer designation. And she works for the Richardson Law Firm, which is, I found out, has an office on Nantucket, Cape Cod, and Eastern Massachusetts. So welcome, Sandy.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. Thank you both.
Yeah, I hope it's not just Nantucket, because otherwise, you know, we'll have to go get divorced over there.
You know, come on over to the island. Why not?
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for coming to this episode of the Divorce Friday podcast. It is a podcast that addresses your financial questions about divorce. And so we aim to come with a new episode every week. And I'm Chris Chen. I'm a certified financial planner and a certified divorce financial analyst in Newton. And you are?
I'm Diane Pappas, and I'm a certified divorce financial analyst and a certified Quadro specialist. And I work out of Gloucester, Massachusetts.
Wonderful. And obviously, this is Sandy Lundy, an attorney in Nantucket and other places also, not just Nantucket. So if you have found us on the Facebook page, please like the Facebook page. If you have found us from Twitter, please like us on Twitter. And if you have any questions, please ask your questions in the Facebook page. I found in this past week that someone had sent us a messenger message, Facebook messenger message on Facebook, that may or may not work as well as one expects. You can find us at divorcefriday.com. And you can send us mail at divorcefriday@gmail.com. That gets to both Diane and I, and we can then figure out who it is addressed to. Okay. And finally, so we are talking today about factors to determine child support. And these are the factors that are written into the current child support guidelines, which went into effect a couple of weeks ago at this point. Right? So there we are. So let's get started, right? And let's see what we can learn about child support and the factors that we should or consider at least before determining what it is.
Right. And so I guess to get that started, we need to understand, what are the factors?
Actually, maybe even before that, isn't that just a calculation that we do, right? I mean, most people think of filling, even professionals, think of just filling the worksheet for child support guidelines. So why do we have to consider factors, Sandy?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of factors that the judge has to consider that impact how much of the guidelines are, how much child support needs to be paid. And then there are deviations, which are, which a judge may consider, which also impacts how much child support may be paid. There are the mandatory factors, you know, income, other family obligations to other families, whether they're Social Security benefits or SSDI benefits. There are a list of mandatory factors, and they basically go into the formula. Okay, they are what they are. They're concrete. They are what they are. But this is not a mechanical exercise. It's not a mechanical exercise at all. And the court can consider special circumstances, and everybody should think about what special circumstances might apply to their case. They're called, and that allows the judge to do what's called a deviation, a departure, either more child support or less child support.
Right. Because right now what we do is we plug in the income figures. We'll add a health care cost, you know, the health insurance, dental and vision insurance. Then we might also add in some child care if the children are younger. So like you said, those are known factors, and those are part of the fill in the blank on the worksheet. Right. And when we fill in those things, it'll come back with a weekly child support figure. And so what you're saying is we have to look at these other factors, because that may or may not be enough.
Right.
I mean, if the child support factors were just what's written on the page and that's it, then a robot could do it, right? I mean, it would just be automatic. But you need to consider, is there another family? Is there a subsequent family for which support is needed? Is there a prior child support obligation? If there isn't a prior child support obligation, is it a fact that your client is actually supporting another child? The guidelines recognize that as a possible reason for deviation. And what about your kids? I mean, what are the special needs of the children, and not just special needs in terms of disability, but you know, is a child of, I was using the example before we got on, is the child a violin prodigy and the parents have to spend money for a very expensive violin? I have a client whose son is a very, very talented guitarist, and guitars cost a lot of money, and he needs a certain number of guitars. And you know, how does that get factored into the child support guidelines? So I meant to shut my phone off and I turned it on. It's really the details of each particular family that make make the art of the child support guidelines. There's a science, which is the robotic formula, and then there's the art.
Right.
Okay, so actually sort of, I think, challenges what most people think out there about child support. I think most people think of child support as addressing the basic needs of the child. And we often refer it as food, shelter, and clothing. Right. And so you mentioned some things that are a little bit different and that often are taken care of in essentially as other expenses beyond child support.
Right.
Violent lessons you were mentioning earlier.
Yeah. I mean, the court in this child support guidelines, the 2020 guidelines report, says the court should look at extracurriculars and allocate extracurricular, it has the discretion to allocate extracurricular expenses, which, you know, in that case, that's something that you would want to bring the attention of the court to. You know, the court, there's no reason for the court to know that there's anything different other than the mechanical formula if you don't tell the judge, you know, and that's why clients need to be really specific. Think about what's going on with my family. What are the economic needs that may not be cookie cutter? Mm-hmm. And make sure you tell them to your attorney, your CPA, your financial advisor.
Yeah.
Because they may, I'm not saying they always will, but they may be something that will factor into the guidelines.
Yeah. I'm always telling my clients, you know, that I love people to work on a cash flow, you know, their expenses, to do my worksheet, my 4-page worksheet that I have. And I always say, please, you know, really understand what it costs for your child to raise your child, because we need to look at all those expenses, just like you're saying, because, you know, there's not a lot, not enough space on the financial statements for people to fill that all out. And they leave out a lot of expenses. And I think that's kind of what you're saying. Sometimes that happens. We're on the financial statement. There's not enough place for people to put all the expenses for the children, or they don't think there is. And so they leave things out that are important.
I always tell my clients, you know, put exactly what you're saying, Diana. And in my experience, you would think, people think that people exaggerate their expenses, but more often than not, people minimize their expenses. They don't count everything that they really need to live.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that comes from not remembering at the time that you fill the worksheet what these expenses are. Mm-hmm. Like, so to pick a non-directly child-oriented expense is that if you pay your car insurance once a year at the time that you you submit your numbers, you may not have thought of it because it was like 9 months ago and you don't remember.
Right.
That's right. That's why you should go over your past year or maybe 2 years worth of credit card statements and bank accounts. That will jog your memory. That'll tell you, oh yeah, right, I paid my car insurance in a lump sum, or oh, I paid this tuition, you know, and forgot to add it. Mm-hmm. Really important for people to be very, very, to spend a lot of time really, really understanding what their expenses are.
And I think for a lot of people, it's a painful exercise.
It is. It's always painful because you're always most people are spending more than they bring in. Mm-hmm. And it's really painful when you see that in the figures. I mean, it's really painful, but you know, the truth shall set you free. I mean, you need to know, and the judge needs to be able to calculate. You need to know it for your post-divorce planning, right?
Yes.
And you need to know it in terms of, you know, what is your real, what's the need of this family and how do we get there? Maybe it means that that somebody needs to work, needs to have a different work employment or work hours or something. So yeah. Families like to walk away from their economic realities because they are painful.
Yeah, I think a fundamental point that you're bringing up there is that there are really two uses for that collection of information. One of them is so that it can be tabulated and put on the court mandated documents, right? And that it can be added and put into and compared to whatever the child support worksheet spits out. But the more important aspect that I tell everyone is, you know, it's not really so much about the court and the judge and whatnot. And I hope no judge is listening right now, but but it is about the people there, about how can they use that information to then plan for the future.
Yes.
I mean, the reality is that living in two different households is going to cost more than a single household. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says it's 25% more on average. And there is a recent academic study that suggested that it is 28%. Right? And so therefore, a lot of these expenses that we're talking about that are potentially worthy of deviation may have to be amended in order to fit into the family's budget. And when I mean the family's budget, I mean both parents.
Yeah.
You said something, you know, how parents have to really look at the specific situation for their children, right? You know, it's something where they're gifted or whatever. Another thing that I see a lot now, unfortunately, are costs for a therapist and for testing of children. You know, for maybe these special educational plans. And that I'm unfortunately seeing a lot of this. You know, sometimes three children are in therapy and they're going to need testing, you know, for the next couple of years in school. So I think that is one of those deviation factors that, you know, definitely have to be accounted for.
That's right. And, you know, if someone looks like they need to be in institutional placement, maybe not immediately, but, you know, soon down the line, that needs to be accounted for. I mean, there are a lot of those, and you're right, I'm seeing the same thing. I'm seeing a lot of IEP evaluations. Maybe the child will need to flourish in a special school, mm-hmm. and that needs to be taken into consideration. So, the overall resources of the family need to be taken into consideration. That's why I rely so much on people like Diane and Chris, because it would be great if everybody could spend as much as they could on kids, send them to the best college they could, the most expensive one, the best special school they could. But one of the interesting things that's built into the 2021 guidelines is this presumption that if the payor is paying more than 40% of their income in child support, that's presumptively wrong. You know, so it's always a balancing act. And that's why you'll see in these new guidelines for people making under, I believe it's $200 or $210, the mandatory minimum child support used to be $25 and now it's $12. So, right. And on both ends, and in the high end, you have the $400,000 because that's that basically comports with where income is going in Massachusetts. The $250,000 baseline was set in 2009. Yes. So, there also is, if you're on the other side, you want to think about the balance and you want to argue, you want to look at the what's really affordable.
Yeah. So going back to what you just said about the income limits. So in the past, the understanding, whether right or wrong, was that if a family had up to $250,000 in combined gross income, that there would only be a child support order. And that at that point, there if you were under 250,
there would not be an alimony order in addition to the child support.
Right. So it would only be child support and there would be no opportunity for alimony. So now it almost seems like raising it to 400 has given people the opportunity to possibly consider alimony and child support. Right. So this is something we definitely wanted to talk about with you, because it has been mentioned that now maybe, and this has always been in the case, but for some reason it kind of got lost, is that if there is an alimony case, and that's something we want to talk about, there is an alimony case, that it's quite possible for us to calculate alimony first and then use that income for the recipient, take it off the income for the payor, and then calculate child support.
So from a practical standpoint, does that work, Sandy?
I'm going to give you such a lawyer's answer. It depends. It depends on the family and it depends on the income. So when things depend, you have to step back and think not just what is the rule, but what's the reason for the rule. Okay. Here, the reason for the rule is to maximize the income available to the child. So given the number of children, the particular child, the income of the parents, most lawyers will do it or need to do the calculation both ways. One way using alimony first and the second way using child support first, and seeing which number, which way gives you the maximum benefit for the family. Now, I wish that, I mean, in some ways it's unfair, because in some courts the judge will always do it one way and in some courts the judge prefers to do it another way. And for me, and this is just my editorial and, you know, whatever you want to do with it, but the purpose of child support guidelines should be to ensure consistency, that you go to any judge and come out with the same number of the formula. You know, deviations will always be discretionary, but because different judges have different preferences about what to do first, that's not always the case in terms of calculating alimony or child support. So that's unfortunate. I mean, there should be some more clarity. Maybe somebody should be responsible for telling the judge what maximizes the overall benefit to the family. Maybe there should be a joint submission by the parties, with both formulas. But it shouldn't be that it depends on what court you're in or what judge you get.
So the last time around that we changed the child support guidelines, like 4 years ago, there was a flurry of thinking going around that alimony should potentially be calculated first, exactly the same argument we're having now. Right. And I think that it died out, it petered out after just a few months.
It
did. After a few months, and we stopped talking about that, and everyone went back to doing child support and forgetting about the alimony part.
Right. Right. I mean,
is it likely to happen the same way?
Yeah. I mean, if you've got a children that are older, it may make sense to do alimony first because the child support will disappear sooner. Mm-hmm. Right. If they're younger children, maybe that doesn't work so well.
Yeah.
But again, this is the art part of the, you know, of the guidelines, and that really and how artful you are depends on the collaboration between the attorney, the client, and the financial advisor, and how they understand the numbers and can present them to the judge.
Right. Yeah,
that's an interesting point. I'm sorry, Adan. You go ahead. I've been on my train of thoughts and I couldn't help it.
I get my brain, my brain is ticking here, but and I was just going to forget what I. Oh, but the point is determining what is an alimony case. You know, I have clients who now have heard this podcast, and she said, "Oh, great! Now I can get alimony." But when I looked at the income levels, I'm like, no, their incomes were only $40,000 different. And I said, I don't think this is an alimony case. I don't think you can do it because there wasn't a need. The incomes were so close, I don't think there was a need. So I think it's really important, and I know you're going to say it depends because how do we determine if it is an alimony case and we do need to consider alimony first? That's the hard part.
No. I'll tell you really that this is the formula that the court uses, or this is the theory behind it. Basically, alimony is a function of the payor's ability to pay, mm-hmm. all right, and the payee's need for support. And the need for support is key to the marital lifestyle. So, if people it doesn't just mean subsistence support, it's key to the marital lifestyle. Obviously in the case that you're talking about, Diane, it doesn't make sense. And but when you have as all of us have come across, a one person who pays a lot of who is the breadwinner and another person who's not, I mean, it's hard to believe even on a moderate income level that there wouldn't be some kind of support, particularly if there are no kids.
Right.
I think
Diane was thinking of different cases where there was substantial income on both sides. Right. But it's an interesting point that you brought there. I'm sorry about the having teenagers or kids closer to emancipation, because I think that the general way that people think is we'll have child support, and when child support runs out, we'll go back to court and figure out alimony, which, is feasible, but is expensive.
Well, you better be real clear about what your separation agreement says. If the separation agreement says that alimony survives, you're going to have a very, very hard time going back. I don't know if you have both discussed the difference between survival and merger of an agreement.
I think we should explain it.
the basic way to put it is, if a provision of a separation agreement merges, then it can be changed or modified with the substantial change in circumstances. Okay, if it survives, that's pretty much one and done, unless the circumstances are so extreme that somebody, is very sick and becoming a public charge. And I mean, the circumstances are very extreme. You might as well just call it one and done. Mm-hmm. So if your alimony provision survives, you're not going back and getting alimony.
Right. Yep. So the only way it's modifiable is if alimony merges. So with the agreement.
And so let's talk about merger and survival, Diane. What does that mean for the public who doesn't know merger and survival?
Well, we just said, so if alimony survives, it means that you have agreed that neither one of you can go back for any reason to ask for alimony, except if you're saying, Sandy, there's really extreme circumstances. But like you said, if your alimony survives, you basically cannot go back and ask for it at a later date. Child support is always modifiable because that is merged always. And alimony can be merged as well. And
so, I'm sorry. So how do you know what's what? Well, it's going to be right there in your separation agreement. The separation, and your lawyer sort of explained this to you before you signed the agreement, but it's going to say which provision, you know, every provision in your separation agreement can have two consequences. It could either, one of two consequences, it could either merge or survive. And somewhere in the agreement, usually in the front, it specifies which provisions merge and which provisions survive. Now, again, that's not mechanical. That's not inevitable with alimony. Whether it survives or merges is a function of negotiation.
So that's really important. So that's an interesting thing. If you have child support, it's only going to last for a couple of years, because at that point the kids will be graduated or whatever, and there won't be any more child support. But you had a 30-year marriage and you still need some support after that. So in that case, you could switch to alimony, but you better make sure that your alimony merges with the agreement.
Right. Or that your agreement says unallocated or unallocated support, which is like, it's not alimony. We're not calling it alimony. We're not calling it child support. So at least you have that foothold going into a modification.
This is going to be a hot topic for time, some time to come, as far as calculating alimony first. Is this an alimony case? And I am already getting clients asking me. And this, these guidelines just went into effect on October 4th. So we're already getting questions, and I know it's going to continue. So it's just really important, I think, to consult and just look at all the options. And I just did something for a client where I had 7 different scenarios of alimony and child support, and looking at the bottom line saying, this isn't going to work. Look, when you put the alimony and child support together, all of a sudden he's got nothing left. He has a lot less net income after taxes than she does. So at that point, he doesn't have the ability to pay.
I think that's one of the things that people forget, right? Is that, child support is not taxable to the recipient and is not tax deductible to the payor. And people say, but it is only a small percentage of the payor's income, but the payor gets to pay all of the taxes, mm-hmm. right? And that effectively their after-tax income is not after-tax, after child support, after alimony income is going to be much less than people imagine.
And there's people say, well, I need that money, and they can pay, but the payor needs to live. Mm-hmm. So, and it has a right also to live as close to the marital lifestyle as possible. So, it's at the end of the day, like Chris was saying, you're not, everybody's overall financial health will take a little bit of a hit.
Yes.
And you've got to adjust. And that's why you guys are so valuable. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, not engaging a financial professional in the beginning of any divorce case, because getting someone out of a divorce in an economically sound position is as important or more important than getting the divorce itself.
No, we totally agree.
Yeah. Oh, that's a surprise.
Yep, I work with Diane a lot. She's fabulous. Yeah, Chris is fabulous. They're both great.
So one of the things that happens with the current guidelines is that the levels of support, the level of child support using standard assumptions actually goes up significantly compared with the previous version, right? And perhaps it has an impact also on that alimony question that you were raising, right? So in the higher income brackets in particular, it goes up significantly, right? And so if there is that significant increase, does it reduce alimony?
Well, theoretically, yes. And one of the reasons that it goes up so high is this: the way that childcare costs are factored into the new guidelines. There's actually a $355 assumption that of it's like a cap, a ceiling, but there is an assumption now that the parties will share child care costs, whereas it used to be, or it was often the case in the old guidelines, that somebody would take that child care credit, and usually the higher earner, not always, but usually, and that would, you know, reduce the overall amount of child support. So, yeah, you can't expect child support to exert upward pressure on alimony. It just won't do that, because one person's income almost always can't justify that raise.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So then another area that we always want to talk about, and the parties are always bringing this up, is when you have kids that are 18 to 23.
Oh, you're making faces. Right.
You made a face. Hey, Sandy, can you just tell us what the guidelines are right now for kids over 18 to 23 that fall into that area?
Well, usually for a child over 18, there is a 25% reduction in the child support, but the judge can cut it down to zero, depending on what the college costs are. Mm-hmm. You know, so again, and there's two levels. I mean, in the regular guidelines, if a child is 18 and they're still in high school, the guidelines considers them to be under 18 and factors them, you know, in that category of children. If they're over 18 and not yet 21 and living with the custodial parent and dependent on the custodial parent, you know, the guidelines apply. If they're going to college, the guidelines may or may not apply, but you get a reduction for children who are over 18.
Right. The payor gets a reduction, right?
The payor, I'm sorry. Yes, yes.
And the reason why is because they're assuming, I believe, and this is what I don't know if it's right or not, but one of the parties is responsible for the college tuition. So, and also the children are not in the home. They may be home, but most kids go away to college. And so is that reduction taking that into account, that maybe they're out of the house, so maybe they're not incurring those everyday expenses for a child? Or is it because maybe the payor is paying college, and you know, the recipient and the payor are paying some sort of college tuition, and that's why it's reduced?
Well, I think there's also an assumption of that when you're 18, you're more likely to have some kind of mobility or job or whatever. And that's why you have to look at what is that 18-year-old doing? Are they going, do they have a job? Is it a full-time job? Did they go into the Army? I mean, there are all kinds of things that you look at to figure out where that 18-year-old will fit. Are they legally considered emancipated? If they're not considered emancipated, what are they doing? And if they're just laying around the house, you know, I've had judges say, look, you know, there's no reason why this child shouldn't be contributing something. So
shouldn't that be case dependent? I mean, we know that at 18, kids become legally adults. I mean, they can vote. Right. They can join the service. They can go to war and get killed and all of these things. But in reality, what's the difference between someone who's almost 18 and someone who just turned 18? In reality, is that from a developmental standpoint, there is a need for transition from being a high school student to being to work.
I've been in divorce trials where that very argument was persuasive. Maybe your kid has depression. Maybe there's something that, you know, what is going on with this 18-year-old that's still living in the house that's dependent on the custodial parent? This is the kind of situation where if you don't know the specifics, you really can't make the best decision in terms of child support. And the judge doesn't have, you want to give the judge the most perfect information you can, let's put it that way. The judge can't intuit anything. The lawyer can't intuit anything. Everybody really depends on the client to tell them what's going on in their family.
Right. And the judge can only look at the financial statement as that snapshot in time to see what the financial situation is of that parent. Yeah. And if that's not accurate and the other details aren't in there, then it's the judge isn't going to know it.
And it sounds repetitive, but it's actually something that people just don't do enough of. So that's why I repeat it a lot.
So just getting back to college tuition too, that's another thing that I hear all the time. The father, just a typical scenario, is paying for college. And so he says, well, why do I also have to pay for child support? And that is a very common question.
Yeah, and they may or may not at the end of the day have to pay for child support, but they would because generally the primary custodial parent still has to maintain a home for that child. All right. So they've still got a two bedroom instead of a one bedroom, and they're still going to have the child over the Christmas break and over the summer. The child still has needs at home, and that's basically why. But again, if the tuition is exorbitant and the payor looks like he's getting to that, and I'm saying he, but he's getting to that 40%, presumptive mark, judges will look at it.
I mean, tuition, college costs, tuition, room and board, et cetera, are not part of child support. They're extra, they're additional, they're separate.
Right. There's a benchmark in the child support guidelines. It basically says that no one parent can be required to pay more than 50% of the in-resident tuition at room, board, and tuition costs for the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of times parents say, I want to pay more. I want to send my son to Harvard, whatever. That's fine if the child gets in and somebody's paying, but that doesn't mean that they're also going to have to pay child support if they're voluntarily and with the agreement of the parties putting the child into a highly expensive school.
I think we'll address, Diane, we're addressing college in another episode, are we?
We are, yes, we are. Yeah. So we just wanted to touch on it quickly here.
Yeah. I'd like to get to the question of parenting time, because parenting time is one of the key factors enshrined into the worksheets of determining the level of child support. And one of the things that seems to be happening is that parents who normally wouldn't want to have an excessive amount of parenting time all of a sudden claim 50% because it reduces child support.
Nothing gets me more angry, actually, as an attorney, as when somebody appears to be doing that. And if it's my client, I tell them to knock it off. And if it's the other side, I make the argument to the judge. I mean, there are a lot of times when parents divorce and the person who hadn't been involved generally wants to be more involved in the family. But there are other times when, I had a case where the father wanted 50% time and said to the judge, you know, the part of the reason is he didn't philosophically believe in child support. Well, you can imagine how well that went over. So really, again, does the person really want the child or really want a reduction in child support or elimination? And sometimes, you know, a deposition can uncover a lot there. Who's your child's teacher's name? What are you going to do for daycare? When is the aftercare kick in? Who are the child's best friends? I mean, you know, a lot of times you can, when it's a transparent ploy to get pay less child support, I think that your lawyer needs to make that case.
Yeah.
And the ultimate thing when you're talking about custody is the best interest of the children. Is it in the best interest of the children? Is this custodial arrangement in the children's best interest when, you know, the non-custodial parent has a history of drug abuse or has, you know, has only one bedroom and there are three kids? You know, that's what you have to argue.
Right. Yeah. So I have an example, which is really horrible, but I have an example of a case that I worked on where there was in mediation. There was no, they didn't go to court. And they finally agreed to 50-50 parenting time division. And even though the father in that case wasn't really in a good position to do 50-50, and what happened is that a lot of the time, certainly not all of the time, but a lot of the time what happened is that the father's girlfriend's mother was the one doing the babysitting while the girlfriend and the father were off doing something else.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to be counter to the definition of parenting time.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it reminds me, Chris, of when people say, employers say to women, sure, you can work 80% time. We'll give you 80% salary and you'll work 80% time so you can be home with your kids. And the women end up working 100% of the time anyhow. And a lot of times in these joint, 50-50 custody arrangements, the traditionally non-custodial parent will send the kids back to the traditionally custodial parents. So, you know, more than 50% of the time. And, you know, that's when you go in for a modification and say, look, this isn't really a 50-50 arrangement. This person never intended it to be a 50-50 arrangement. I watch the kids 60% of the time.
Yeah, it shouldn't even, I mean, it shouldn't even get to that point, unfortunately, you know, and like the mother, I hear the mother, you know, telling me he travels for work. There's no way he's going to be able to do 50%. He's just not that kind of guy. And yeah. I'm like, well, you know, I don't know. I know what you're saying. I get it. And, you know, unfortunately, that's where they end up. And then, yeah. you know, the mother or the care, whoever is home, the custodial parent is just not receiving enough income to cover the extra time that she now has the child at home.
Right. You know, I think a lot of payors think of child support as extra money for the ex.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And don't tie it to the children. And I think that's a function of bad education. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, people need to be educated about what child support is and why you have child support. But the prevailing myth that when you're giving money, child support money to your ex, they're going to go out and buy a Mercedes with it is really tough.
Yeah, no. And I have a personal experience. I always share a tidbit here or two about my own divorce. And my children were older. They were driving cars. So there was a need for gas and whatnot. I was receiving child support. And so when my kids were with him, you know, like, Dad, can I have some money for gas? No, I give your mother child support. I'm like, no, that's not how it works.
Right, right. Plus, the worst thing is saying that to a kid. Because what you're doing is you're putting the child in the middle. The parents should never discuss the divorce with the children, or else, yeah, and certainly never discuss no part of a divorce, but especially finances, or give the child the child support check or the alimony check to give to the payee. I mean, that is such a good way to land your kids on the couch for a very long time in their adulthood.
Well, luckily, I set my kids straight. But
I'm not saying, I'm not talking about your kids. I'm just talking in general.
I know, but I can, you know. Also, then the question my daughter said is, "Well, he's not allowed to give you any more money, like any money. You know, he's not allowed to give us money." I'm like, "Of course, he's allowed to give you money. He just doesn't want to because he thinks he's giving it to me." Because it was that whole thing of I'm giving it to her and she doesn't need it.
Right. I think it's important for, I think it's the position of a lot of parents going to the process that they just don't want to give money to their ex. And I get the point, right? But someone needs to set people straight, right? It's eventually some of that child support money may somehow trickle to the ex, but it's about, you know, supporting the family, right? Just as before the divorce, it's just different. It's a different support, and it's a different structure, and it's a different support.
It could be a lot better if the court, and I don't care what organization created this pamphlet, but if there was just an information sheet about child support that went out to every family that had in which there was a possibility of a child support order, just a little educational pamphlet. Like they have great pamphlets about shared parenting. You know, it's a step at least.
Let's write one, Sandy.
Okay. You and I, we'll do it. Chris, you're welcome to join us. Let's do it.
Sounds like
We'll write a pamphlet. No, I agree with you because there is a lot of misconception, and it gets even muddied when you even try to read the guidelines, you know, when you send the guidelines to a client. So there's so many gray areas, but
One of the things that happened out of this latest revision is that there was before October 4th, a requirement for parents to attend a parenting class.
Yes.
And that's gone.
It's gone because it was, the research said that it wasn't helping.
Really?
It's actually research-based. Yeah. It said it wasn't really helping. Now, there are programs that help parents, especially in really high conflict divorces. And sometimes the court will mandate that the parents go to them. There's a wonderful high conflict divorce program from William James College. It's 9 weeks. I think it's expensive, but there are scholarships available. So there are programs that that the science backs, but these weren't it.
I did not realize that research is why the mandatory parenting class was canceled. I did not know that.
Yeah, it wasn't effective. It was hard to maintain standards between the different groups. The quality varied so much. I mean, I've had parents that told me this is the best class I ever took. This can be great for me. And some parents had said, oh my God, this was like sitting through, you know, your worst topic in high school where you're just doodling in your notebook. So,
full disclosure, I went to a mandatory parenting class and I was very fragile at the time. And I think I cried for the majority.
You don't remember much.
I don't remember. I was too busy crying.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a lot, there are courses that do help, and getting a PC involved could help. There's a lot of resources.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Very cool. It sounds, Diane, it sounds like we're getting to the end of the topic, are we?
Yeah. Well, we did great. Obviously, we could spend a lot more time. And, you know, I think one of the areas that I was just thinking about, Chris, is really doing more on alimony. I just think it's really important.
You can have an alimony series.
I think we should have an alimony series.
Have an alimony series.
And Sandy, you'll be joining us for our alimony series.
Oh, well, thank you. I'd love to. There's so many, you know, there's so many misconceptions around support, child support, alimony.
It's one of the things.
Insurance. Yeah. Right.
And it's one of the things that contributes to the contentiousness of a case.
Right.
Because, right. You know, it is it's a case specific issue and it can't be resolved, you know, just by filling in the numbers. And, you know, and then you have to maybe rely on a judge. And I just wish there was, you know, like, we always have to kind of work under the shadows of what the judge would say or what the court would do if we're like in alternative dispute resolution, like mediation or collaborative. And we're always just kind of like saying, well, this is what a judge would do, but we can do something a little different. And that makes it really hard, you know, to like, what is the right thing to do? So.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see if we can close now. So we should remind everyone here that, circumstances are different for everyone. Sandy said it depends a couple of times, and it does depend. So if you have a case that you would like to discuss, please reach out to either of us or to your lawyer or whatever other professionals you deal with, and check it out with them. A podcast will not replace a consultation with a professional. So we are coming back again next week. And Dan, I've already forgotten what we're talking about
next week. Well, I remember this next week. So we're actually having attorney Teresa Reed join us. And we are going to talk about the expenses that are not covered under child support and how those expenses, kind of a lot of the same ones we were talking about, Sandy, the ones that might cause deviation. You know, we're going to talk a little more in depth about those types of expenses. So that's next Friday.
I think that sounds like it's going to be a lot of interesting talk there.
Yep, as always.
So thank you for joining us on this episode of our live Divorce Friday podcast. It's a podcast that answers financial questions about the divorce.
And
thank you everyone for coming. And
don't forget TGIDF. Thank goodness it's Divorce Friday. And Sandy, thank goodness you were here this morning to help us out on this topic.
Well, thanks to the two of you. I really enjoyed myself. Thanks for inviting me.
Awesome.
Thank you, Sandy.
Great.